Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network in Genocide Studies. My name is Yakir Englander, your host. Today we will speak with the editors of Collection of Articles, The Struggle for Understanding, Elie Wiesel Literary Works, published in 2019. Elie Wiesel grew up in a Hasidic Jewish mystical family and community in Sziget in Eastern Europe. But in 1944, as a young boy, he was taken to Auschwitz. In his novels From the Night, The Gates of the Forest, and more, Elie Wiesel touches the hardest questions about life after the Holocaust, the meaning of the relationship among humans and between people and the divine. He meditates about love and prayers, trust and touch, and as few examples. In this collection of articles, we find the newest scholarly voices around the literary works of Wiesel, who passed away in 2016. The editors, Victoria Nesfield is a research coordinator in the Humanities Research Center at the University of York in the United Kingdom, and Philip Smith, a professor of English at the Savannah College of Art and Design in Hong Kong. So, Vicky and Phil, welcome to the New Books Network. My first question for you is, can you share something about yourself that have made you to dedicate some of your research to the Holocaust and more specifically to Elie Wiesel? Vicky, maybe we start with you.
Of course. Well, my background is in Holocaust literature and testimony, and my PhD looked at Wiesel and Primo Levi and really a comparison of the two. And what got me interested in that research in the first place to begin with was Primo Levi, and I was just reading The Drowned and the Saved, and it was one of those really fortuitous instances. I don't know why I picked the book up. I don't know why I bought it, but I did while I was doing my undergraduate degree, and I was really only about 30 pages into it when I knew that I wanted to really pursue Holocaust literature, Holocaust testimony. There was just something about the way it could be written so powerfully, so beautifully, and weave in these theological questions and the historical and the traumatic, and just in such a captivating way that I would say that's the thing that grabbed me. Something that I didn't intend to study, didn't intend to read, just captivated me so quickly and has held my interest all these years.
Thank you. Phil, what about you?
So I feel like there was a point in my life where for A-level I did history, literature and economics. And there was a while where I was putting serious consideration into studying economics as an undergrad. I had two wonderful teachers at A-level where they were really encouraging, and it was the first experience I had of kind of occupying a book in a way where kind of the language becomes your own and you kind of live inside a text. And that made me want to pursue English literature. When I was an undergraduate, I was a bit of a, or I sort of thought myself something of an iconoclast, in that I was more interested in studying kind of pop culture through literature rather than the kind of the classics. And from that, I got interested in art studies, and I discovered Art Spiegelman's Mouse, which was a comic which sort of from as soon as I read it, I didn't stop writing about it, and I haven't stopped writing about it. So I did, I studied it for my MA thesis. I did my PhD on Spiegelman. And so my interest kind of grew from there. It's such an incredible, powerful work, and one that I keep on coming back to and keep on being surprised by. And so it was through Spiegelman that I kind of encountered other forms of Holocaust literature, and this is a subject I kind of grew into from there.
Hmm. Thank you. It's so interesting how we come to projects, right? What capture us, what make us to choose that. So when we think about Elie Wiesel and your specific project, I wonder if you can share with us a little bit, what did you find missing in the research about Elie Wiesel? Because he's one of the writers, one of the survivors and writers and theologians that so much was written, right, about him. And I also, if you can say something about the title, I love your title, The Struggle for Understanding, yes? And your choice to focus on the literature of Elie Wiesel. Can you share with us what was missing there and your choices about the title?
I think to talk about the first point initially, what was missing, there wasn't too much missing, I would say, in terms of the biographical work on Wiesel and actually a lot of commentary on his early things. But what we point out in the introduction and what we were both struck by when talking about this in the very early days of the project is just how much he had written and how noticeably he has outpaced those commentators. So the secondary reading, the academic writing on him, it seems couldn't keep up with him. He just continued to write. He continued to evolve his style in some ways, but at the same time keep revisiting those themes, keep refreshing them, and just keep coming up with new texts and new perspectives that are really interesting, really valuable. But he was just writing at such a rate and publishing at such a rate right up until 2012, I think, was Hostage. And we were struck by how much of the later writing there was and how valuable it was in its own right, but also in comparison with the early writing, but there just wasn't the commentary out there on it.
Yeah, I'd echo that. I think that there's no paucity of writing, but it's a commentary on such a large body of work that there's so much to be said and so much to be kind of built upon. And if you think about, I mean, people are still writing about Hamlet. There's no point where we can kind of say of a writer, okay, that's it. We've said everything that's to be said. Because, of course, any work comes to mean something else as the world changes and as readers change and as new people encounter these works. And then, again, as Vicky was saying, there's this kind of this later work that whilst criticism seems to center on Night, primarily, and then on the kind of the biographical stuff, there was the Sonnenberg case, there's Hostage, there's kind of so much more stuff that was being put out. It's such a rich body of literature to keep on going back to.
And Phil, can you share with us about the title? The Struggle for Understanding. Why this title?
I think, as much as I'd like to take credit for it, and again, this is a few years, a book is a long time in the making. So we kind of, as I was reading the intro again, I was thinking of remembering what it'd be like 4 years ago being in the library and ordering these books. So my memory may be a little hazy, but I believe that the publisher, I think we went for something far more prosaic. Initially, it was just going to be, you know, the novels of. And the publisher said, how about The Struggle for Understanding? And we were like, yes, great, let's do that. So I think credit goes to that. Am I remembering that right, Vicky?
Yes, absolutely. That's my memory too.
Okay, good.
I really loved how much, as I was reading the different articles in the book, I was thinking about that so many of them try to touch maybe like two elements of understanding. The understanding of Wiesel to try to understand what's happening to him. And the language that he has like two languages, right? He has a language of the Hasidic, the mystical Jewish world, that he tried to give words for that, right? He tried to capture what is happening with this language, but also he has the more post-Holocaust language, you know, the literature that he's writing, the world that he is inside, because he chose after the Holocaust not to go back to the Hasidic Vizhnitz dynasty, but to live, you know, in Paris, in the United States, to have a dialogue with other writers and philosophers and politicians. I also think about the question that probably we all ask, right? I mean, how to understand the Holocaust. As a Holocaust, I'm second generation. I think it's a question that we still struggle with. I mean, I don't know how to understand what's happened, not from the historical point of view, but from the existential point of view. And it leads me to my next question that I really want to learn from you. So you choose to focus on the literature of Wiesel. And I wonder, as scholars of literature, I wonder about the relationship between literature and history. Because on the one hand, unlike history, literature give us much more, maybe the deepness of not the fact, but what's happening to the people, right? I mean, they can write about the inner world that is happening for them during the Holocaust. However, I think about so many of us, we know the Holocaust by Paul Celan, by Elie Wiesel, by Primo Levi, and in a way, it's not exactly what happened. And it's a question that I know Wiesel, for example, he insists that everything in the night happened. Like he said, like, no, it's about history. He said that in a few interviews. But his other literature is literature. And I wonder if you can share something, if you can give more words, I feel confused here, about this tension between literature and history, mostly about the Holocaust.
Well, I think the Holocaust is maybe a perfect example to me. My feeling is that there is no one history. I mean, to begin with, the concept of history and this idea of a single narrative is flawed, and in any instance, but particularly in this case, and is sort of dangerous. And you go back to this. At its root, this idea that the design of the final solution was to eradicate a culture, a community, an entire body of people, is to take away a history. It was to rewrite history. So there's that sense of there being a version of history. I think the Holocaust shows that to be philosophically a flawed concept. And I think for the to survivors, for those who didn't survive, that there are millions of histories, there are millions of stories, and we don't get to know the history of the 6 million Jewish survivors, the Jewish victims who didn't survive. We get the histories of those who did and who were able to write or to put into words in some way. And so we get a version of history. And as you say quite rightly, for many students, the version of the Holocaust that we get does come from people like Wiesel, because he wrote in such a, in many ways, accessible way. And I think to go back to your earlier point about how he embodies these two worlds, these two languages, one of the things that I'm so struck by, and I think comes through in the work of our contributors, is that for many people who are coming to the Holocaust as young students or from outside, who aren't the second or the third generation survivors, that Hasidic world is quite alien. The language is quite alien, is quite unfamiliar. The theology can be quite an intimidating subject, really, to tackle. And it's so wound up in Wiesel's experience of the Holocaust. It's his community that disappeared. It's those elements of his traditions that he either hung on to or he witnessed in the camps or he saw destroyed. And I think one of the things he's so skilled at as a writer is weaving that language into a more accessible post-Holocaust vocabulary, post-Holocaust culture.
Thank you.
I think this is such a huge topic. Of how do we try to communicate something of this scale through language. And a recurring theme of writers about the Holocaust is that really we can't. This idea of we'd need a new language to really kind of talk about what happened. And there is this kind of, there's almost a kind of an impossibility to writing about the Holocaust, where on the one hand, when in the face of revisionism and fraudulent testimony and things like that, we feel a necessary kind of imperative to be as accurate as possible. But at the same time, writers are faced with this kind of problem of, well, how can you represent a subject of such magnitude, of such an atrocity on this scale? There is no language. It's both sort of traumatic on the individual scale, but also kind of in terms of everything we might think we know about the world, it's hugely disruptive. And so there's a sense in which writers cannot but give as accurate an account as possible, but also in doing so, knowing that they will never be able to kind of fully communicate what happened, even in kind of telling their own accounts. They're describing experiences the equivalent of which we will never experience. And I think that I've had students before where they'll read accounts like Wiesel's and they'll say, oh, this helps me understand what people went through. And I kind of go, I don't think we can. Like, I don't think we can understand. Like, we can listen and we can pay attention and we can try to absorb what these texts tell us. But I don't think we should ever kid ourselves into thinking that we could understand, or we could even kind of grasp in the smallest sense anything other than a kind of a factual kind of account in terms of sort of numbers and dates.
I love it. I love it because it brings us back to the title that right, the struggle for understanding. Mm-hmm. And like, how much should we understand? I mean, what's the ethical question about understanding? Because if I say, okay, so now I understand, in a way, no, you do not. However, if I will not understand at least a bit, so I will not feel connected to the subject, so just leave me alone. And I think about like, as I was working for many years in Jerusalem as a peace activist, And one of the things that many Israeli Jews, they ask Palestinians in dialogue meetings is, please try to understand my past, try to understand the Holocaust. And they say, what can we do for that? And they say, join us for a trip to Yad Vashem, to the Holocaust Memorial Museum. And then when they come to the museum, after that in the other meetings, the Palestinians say, oh, so now you can understand us. This is what we feel many times when we see your soldiers. And then the Israelis get sometimes offended. It's like, no, you cannot compare it to the Holocaust. And I think it's so interesting because the fact that Palestinians from the other side start understanding or feeling, it's also create this community, you know, of and it's so complicated. I don't try to make it less complicated. I just want to show how much it is complicated. And maybe it brings us back to the question of, you know, why Holocaust survivors, they write. And I think also about a meeting between Elie Wiesel and a Palestinian young man that Elie Wiesel describe, that they find a relation, they create a relationship in this meeting because of the common, uncommon relationship and, you know, what's happened to them. Which brings me to my next question for you. There are two fascinating chapters which focus on the question of the role of the madman in one chapter, in the chapter of Jennifer Murray, but also the question of the madman as a prophet, which we know that in Jewish theology, there is very deep connection between the two, prophecy and being a madman, that there is an article by Marie-Catherine Muller. And I wonder if you can speak a little bit to the listeners about this relationship, about the role of being who is normal. Okay, maybe this is a question that I feel in Elie Wiesel. What is normal? I mean, to be in Auschwitz is not normal. And we hear it by the word of Wiesel that he says, my God had died because also my theology, the normal ultra-Orthodox Jewish theology, doesn't work in a way in the Holocaust, right? Because it's not normal. So I wonder if you can share with us a little bit about this relationship, about normality and craziness and madness and prophecy.
Yeah, well, I mean, so there's been kind of various arguments about the question of what is an appropriate kind of emotional or in terms of expression, a response to something which is so shattering and so traumatic and so huge that really it kind of upends any distinction between kind of rationality and the kind of the total system of the ghettos and the death camps of what type of, you know, is there any place for what we might think of as kind of rationality or of kind of normal systems at work? So as you identify, we have a couple of chapters about the way that Wiesel makes use of the madman as a figure who's got a kind of an insight into the world that the other characters don't necessarily have access to. And I think he uses that as a way to kind of address this idea of what could possibly be a rational response to the Holocaust. It reminds me of do you know the short story, The Reverse Bug? By I think
Lord, no.
Where there is an academic conference on the Holocaust, and it gets disrupted by the sounds being played, of screams being played over the sound system. And it just kind of silences all of this discourse. And Seagal says it's about our failure to be horrified 24 hours a day. That even when we try to kind of apply a rational lens to the Holocaust, we've already made a mistake. If we're trying to kind of understand it through structures, which if we are to begin to understand the Holocaust, we need to throw out those structures, would be the argument presented in that story.
Thank you. Please, Vicky.
Yeah, so I was just going to say on the two specific chapters, or just to add to that, we were really pleased to see those two chapters come in and see how well they sync with each other. And in terms of how we employ them in the structure of the book, the first chapter on the prophet figures sits within our first part, which looks largely at Hasidic origins of Wiesel and of his literature. And then we put the second chapter on The Madman by Jennifer Murray into the second part of the book on the other. So we sort of employ them really as a bridge from this Hasidic world, if you like, into the world of the Holocaust and the characters that we find within that and these other characters. I think because there is no sort of rational way of understanding what these prophets see, these visions that they see before the other characters. And so bringing them out of that theological bubble, if you like, and introducing them in a way that the characters can't see, they can't understand, they think the characters are mad, they get very angry. I mean, Mrs. Schachter is the maybe the best example of that. And the frustrations and the real anger that the other people in the cattle wagon feel towards her, and actually the violence that they respond with, that is maybe the only way to force this vision out of this, if you like, this Hasidic tradition of prophecy and into this real world, this new world, this totally irrational world, but the new real world that Wiesel finds himself in and the characters in his novels find themselves in all of a sudden. And it worked, I think, really well to sort of move the text along, move our book along in terms of theme.
Thank you. I also wonder about another fascinating chapter, about the bystander, right? Like the people that know or have some feeling about what's going on, but they choose not to act during the Holocaust. But we also have it in other novels, like when we have the question about the life of the British officers that they capture and how much when the Jewish pro-Israel group, they decide to kill him as a revenge in order to show some to the British. And then the question of Elie Wiesel as a bystander, like how much he's going to be involved in the murderer or military act. But it also put us, the readers, as question of, are you going to be a bystander? I think about what's going on now in the world, right? I mean, so now that we are aware, and I think that, I mean, the fact that we have such a strong media that allow us to have this interview with both of you in three different continental, but we also know much more what's going on in the world because of that. And we cannot run away. And I wonder about this place of the... of us, the people who are sometimes more passive, and what Elie Wiesel exactly want from them and what he wants from us.
I think he takes a very strong line on the bystander. It's there, I think, in so many of his novels that they have such a responsibility that the bystander, it seems such a neutral word or a neutral name for figures who really are not neutral. Their inactivity, their inaction is what ultimately leads to deportations, leads to starvation, leads to abuse going unchecked, unchallenged. So he's very strong, I believe, on that the bystander, it's you still have a moral responsibility. You can't, if you're there, if you can see what's happening, if you know what's happening, you have a responsibility. You can't sort of excuse yourself from history and from historical responsibility, yes, if you were there. But I think at the same time, in terms of employing that role in so many of his books, as much as there's, I'm sure, an immediate emotional response from Frizzell, from other people in his situation or who have been in his situation, to say, why didn't you do anything? Why didn't you say? Why didn't you stop this? His characters, he does try to explore that and to question why, and to look at the reasons why people don't intervene, why they didn't intervene at the time, and to recognize that there is something that holds people back, whether it's fear. Probably it's, in a lot of instances, it's fear. Whether it's the concern that it will cost you something to to save somebody, to protect somebody, to defend a Jewish business, to defend a Jewish community, that would you lose out on doing that? Would these other characters lose something in offering that protection or in intervening in some way? So I think he does use his literature to attempt to explore the mentality of the bystander, but at the same time, I think it's very clear in Wiesel's mind that bystander is not a neutral position.
Yeah, I'd agree. I think that, so Wiesel was very much opposed to not to the fictionalizing of Holocaust accounts, but definitely to kind of sensationalizing or kind of rendering accounts of the Holocaust within kind of sort of Hollywood terms, or that kind of with the three act structure with a cathartic ending. Because I don't think he wanted his readers to feel like they've been let off the hook. He's very interested in kind of the introspection of the way in which, you know, no one's hands are clean here. I think that we who come after would like to imagine, well, you know, I would have been a member of the resistance, or I would have, hidden Jewish people. But the evidence suggests that in the overwhelming majority, people didn't. And when we kind of read heroic accounts of people who did, we give ourselves the kind of the false belief that these kind of acts of bravery were common, when in fact they were overwhelmingly not the norm. And so I think that Wiesel doesn't let us take the easy way out. He's interested in the people who didn't act and can't necessarily articulate why they didn't act. He's far more interested in that than kind of telling stories of heroism and escape.
Yeah, thank you. And I also think it's bringing us back to the place of the madman, because the madman, in a way, demand from the Jewish community to act before, right? I mean, before the Nazis are going to send them to Auschwitz. And the question of why do you identify that person as a madman and it's allow you not to listen to. Which brings me to the third part of the book, which focus on theology and tradition. And what I love so much about this part and the articles you choose to bring to us is a question that Elie Wiesel also demand from Jewish theology to change. I mean, the question of the articles of Ariel, Ivan Mayes, and Dalbo and Sterling are asking questions about what the role of God in the Holocaust, and in a way, the falling of the traditional Jewish theology during the Holocaust, the place of the place of Jewish theology in order to remember, right? And the place, of course, of the Hasidic movement and the Hasidic theology inside that. And again, I want to remind us that in a way, Elie Wiesel, he writes a lot about the ultra-Orthodox and the Hasidic theology. However, he chose after the Holocaust not to live among them. And I wonder, what do you take from these articles, which bring, I think, new light to research of Elie Wiesel and the Holocaust in general about the place of God and theology?
So I would, I want to pick up on how you said these are really good chapters. And one of my feelings about, so I've worked on a few different edited collections, and out of all the ones I've worked on, this one really kind of, it just came together so easily, and it kind of through peer review, and everyone was really awesome. And I'm glad you mentioned these chapters towards the end, because I think a lot of the time I take on a book project like this, or I work on an edited collection like this, because there is a subject I'm interested in, but I'm not necessarily able to kind of unpack it. And so I invite people who have a particular perspective to kind of come and tell me about it. And in the process of them telling me, we kind of, a book appears. I think particularly that chapter by Rabbi Mace is really fantastic. I don't know if I could necessarily do the argument justice here. I think that the role we played, I would say, is just kind of the touches we made to that chapter, I think, were quite minimal. It kind of sailed in pretty much publishable, and it was just a joy to read. And so my suggestion honestly would be for people to check out that chapter, because I don't want to try to do it justice in my own words.
Yeah. So, right? I mean, the role of us as editors, I mean, the role of you as editors, it's like, how do you bring, it's like you give birth to new ideas to come, right?
Yeah.
Yes. Vicky, do you have some memories from, as an editor of this book, about these choices of chapters and theology?
Yeah, and I'd absolutely echo what Phil says, and it really was, I mean, it was a joy to work on the whole project, but yes, these chapters were particularly interesting. And again, I'm not a theologian, I wouldn't want to intervene too much in how they were written. What I would say, though, is that what I think they bring is again, that bridge between a theological world that our readers may not be too familiar with, if at all, and some themes which are more universal, or if not totally universal, that extend beyond Judaism, beyond Hasidism. So theodicy, this idea of this question of, well, can you have a God who is not all good? That that's not exclusively Hasidic, that's not exclusively Jewish. It emerges in other theologies, in the work of other theologians, of course. But the Holocaust it's that perfect storm, if you like, of culture and history, which prompts that. And Wiesel is so well positioned, I think, from his background and his writing style, to really interrogate that. And what our contributors brought, I think, to this section is really exploring those roots that are so personal to Wiesel, to his community, to the Hasidic origins, but presenting them in a way that makes it approachable and debatable to readers who don't necessarily have that language, that vocabulary. And in the texts that they use, I think there's such great choices because they span some of the older texts of Wiesel's write to some of the more modern. So it shows this theme that Wiesel so artfully weaves through his whole body of work.
Yeah, yes.
And he never, I don't think Wiesel ever gives us a kind of an ultimate kind of answer for his position, because I don't think he ever quite did. I think throughout his life, when we visit different kind of periods of his writing, he offers different views of kind of theology and the way in which he ever really kind of reconciles his experiences with his Hasidic education. I think it was a question he kind of kept on coming back to and trying to answer. And I think it's interesting for us to observe that process rather than kind of look at one part of his work in isolation and say, okay, this is what he thought, because it did keep on coming back.
So it's bringing me to the last question, which is the last part of the book. I want to thank you for dedicating a whole part of the book to his later works, because so many times, you know, people focus on the first night and maybe the main literature that he wrote in the first years. And I wonder if you can share with us a little bit about what did you bring into that? I mean, you have a whole chapter about the political vision and how his writings became part of questions about politics, right? Which is so interesting. And also it brings us to the question of what do we want to do with Elie Wiesel, right? So I wonder if you can share a little bit about the choice to bring the later works and what did you find there?
I think we were very keen to have those later works in the volume, not least because, as we discussed earlier on, that's the work that there's so little commentary out there on. Again, we were just very pleased to see what came in from the contributors. We weren't too prescriptive in terms of what we were asking for. We were just very happy to see such a rich breadth of subjects. I think it's important that they're there, particularly the chapter on Wiesel's politics. I think he's such an important name, not just in Holocaust literature, but in Holocaust education, in Holocaust memory. The fact that his reputation and how he's known as a public figure extends beyond literature, the Nobel Peace Prize, the public platform that he had, it gives him more authority, I think. It gives him a platform that other survivors don't have. And it's a question that we look at in the introduction, actually. It's particularly on the second chapter, no, sorry, the first chapter, and how transparent, if you like, Wiesel is about his influences from the early days of Siget and that community as a literary community. And I think we say in the introduction, or we ask in the introduction, do we hold Wiesel to higher standards, perhaps, than we would other writers, particularly other writers of fiction? And I think we do, consciously or not. And I think the fact that he has this public and political platform, which other writers don't have, means that his work might be treated as authoritative, that his writing that might be fictional might be treated as more historically accurate or historically neutral than it may be. And in fact, it's very clearly not politically neutral. I think it's right that it's there. I think he occupies and he assumed that platform, he assumed that public presence to really talk about conflict in the world, and particularly Israel and Israel and Palestine. So he had a voice and he used it and he wanted to share that voice. So I think in terms of his literary body, and the body of work, it's absolutely right that it's there and it's discussed. But also it really brings his work full circle. And of course, we were writing this, or we were putting this book together after Wiesel died. So we sort of bring his literary body back full circle, because so much of this political work from his later years, the references, the early work, or offers a new position. I'm thinking particularly about Hostage and Dawn, and how you could read those two texts together, and how his writing style shifts, how that political angle and his perspective, which to me is so lyrical and torturous and in a way aesthetic in Dawn, becomes much more aggressive and blunter in Hostage. And so I think there's a lot to say about how his writing style shifts, about the world that he was writing in, and the culture and the events that he was perhaps looking back on as he was writing these later texts, but also what it says about how he changed as a public persona and how that might have influenced his writing.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think as well, kind of going back to the introduction, one of the things we say is it's such a shame that he's not still with us, because all the evidence from his writing throughout his life suggests that he would not have stopped if he was still alive. He'd have things to say about our present political moment, and it would be just as sage and just as important as his other work.
I want to thank you for both of you, Phil and Vicky, for first of all for coming here, but also and for sure for editing this such important, I think, book about the works of Elie Wiesel. I love the title, The Struggle for Understanding. I think that now, as people like Wiesel, right? I mean, it was published, I think, a year or two after that he passed away. And I think that now, as more and more the survivors are passing away and they find peace, you know, with their souls, I think that the question and the struggle, the real struggle to keep understanding, but also to take responsibility that such events will not repeat, and other events that are happening today. And I think that Elie Wiesel was such a light, and also someone who said there is light, but also in order to have the light in darkness, we all must not be bystander, but act in each one of us. And even by reading, we already learning something and acting. So thank you so much for editing this book.
Thank you. And thank you for your contribution.
Thank you so much.